Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello and welcome to The Upgrade, a podcast from the team at lifehacker.com, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Andy Orn, editor with Lifehacker.
And this week we're talking to Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter, author, and Lifehacker extraordinaire Charles Duhigg. Charles is the author of the mega best-selling books The Power of Habit, about the science of habit formation, and Smarter, Faster, Better, about the science of productivity, which came out in paperback last week.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We are super excited to have you here today. And I know that you just got off a flight at 1 a.m. this morning.
But I'm feeling amazing.
Okay, good.
I'm feeling like a winner with the 5 hours of sleep I got.
Oh, perfect, perfect. So we'll make sure to make this as rigorous as possible.
You guys might not feel like I'm a winner. You might think I'm way, yeah. But I'm feeling good at least.
Okay, cool. The audience can write to us at upgrade@lifehacker.com and let us know if they think that Charles is a winner or a loser today. I'm going to start with like a question that you're asked constantly, which is how someone who's got a high-pressure job like you, a family, and at the time that you were writing Smarter, Faster, Better, you were doing publicity for your previous book, The Power of Habit, how you managed to write another best-selling book, this one about productivity, in your very few off hours.
That is a great question, because that was actually one of the things that drove me wanting to write this book, which was that I sort of had this this epiphany experience right after The Power of Habit came out, which was that I had been working on The Power of Habit for a number of years at that point, and I published it, and I wasn't certain anyone was going to read it. And then people started reading it, and it was doing well, which I was so thankful for. And I was at The Times, and I was working on this series called The iEconomy, which went on to win the Pulitzer Prize. And so very similarly, like, I got super-duper lucky. And this year, when these two things were happening, this was, like, professionally, like, a dream come true, right? Like, I had, like, a book that was selling well. I was working on a series that went on to win a big prize, and I would come home to, like, you know, after a day at work, to, like, have dinner with my wife and my kids who are young, and I would say to my wife, because I had been working for so long to try and, like, be successful, and I'd say to my wife, you know, if this is what success feels like, then, like, sign me the hell back up for failure, because this is, like, the worst lifestyle I've ever had in my entire life, because I would have, like, you know, 200, 300 emails to deal with every single day. And I would work all day at The Times, and I would come home, and all I really wanted to do was, like, have a glass of wine and talk to my wife and kids about their day. But I would have another 4 or 5 hours of work to do every single night. And I thought to myself, this is crazy, because everybody in the world only has 24 hours in each day, right? President Obama has the same number of hours that I do, and yet that dude seems to get, like, some really impressive stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was looking around, I began to realize there are people who seem significantly more productive, right? Who seem to get not only things done, but get the right things done, the important things done. Whereas I felt like the harder and harder I was running, the farther and farther I was falling behind on the treadmill. And so the one magic power I have as a New York Times journalist is that I can call up almost anyone and ask them embarrassing questions, and they feel like they have to answer me. And so I just started calling all of these researchers who study productivity and all of these, you know, very productive people and saying, what is your secret? Like, why does this happen for you and it doesn't happen for me? And they began giving me these insights that became the book that I actually very much incorporated and embraced as I was writing the book to try and make my life better.
Can I say that, like, you saying that you were falling behind on the success treadmill, like, to me, I'm like, well, you were
right, yeah.
A Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times journalist who had a wife and kids and had also just written a best-selling book that you were promoting. So you sound to me like the type of person that I would have wanted to call up at that point in your life and be like, how did you do that? Because I'm sure that everyone can relate to getting home from work, you know, and sometimes going to work just means sitting at a computer and like whiling the day away.
Yeah.
And then getting home feeling exhausted and just wanting to watch The Real Housewives on TV and like not move until the next day. So you were already kind of a highly productive person.
But here's the thing, and this gets to the core of sort of what productivity is that productivity is not an external judgment. Productivity is basically whether you feel like you're actually on top of things and in control. Productivity is something that we define. It is not an objective standard. What I learned from all those researchers was that the people who are most productive, they get much more done and they are much more successful, not because they are busier, but because they train themselves to think differently about things like setting goals and choosing priorities and remaining focused on what's most important to them and spurring innovation and helping teams come together. That there are different ways of thinking, if you understand how your brain works, that allows you to say, this is what I want to get done. I'm going to get that done while feeling in control and not feeling totally overwhelmed. So you're right. I think from an objective perspective, and my wife and I say this all the time, that, you know, standing outside our lives, we would be envious of our lives. But the point is, we never stand outside our lives. We live our lives. And people who are genuinely successful, people who are two standard deviations of success or disproportionately successful, they are the people who realize, I need to take control of how I'm spending my time and do the things that matter to me. So that if my goal is to have an amazing body, I can do 3 hours of yoga a day. And if my goal is to be incredibly successful at work, I can do the things at work that get the most important things done instead of just replying to emails all day long and 3 years from now wondering why I still haven't gotten that promotion.
Is there any degree to which feeling like you're slightly out of control can actually help motivate you at all?
Well, that's a good question. It's interesting that you use the word motivation there. So there are definitely times when we should embrace feeling un-goal-directed. Right? To say, I want to let my mind wander, or I know what I want a year from now, but I don't know exactly how to get there. And so I'm going to conduct some experiments to see which path gets me there. But there's a difference between saying I embrace a little bit of chaos in my life and saying I feel out of control. And it's interesting you mentioned motivation, because the first chapter in the book is about motivation. And it's about how the Marines remade boot camp entirely in order to teach recruits to crave a sense of control. Because what we know from neurology is that the part of our brain, the striata, where motivation essentially originates from, it is only activated when we feel like we're making a choice, when we feel like we have some agency or autonomy. And so seizing that sense of control, in fact, taking a chore and finding a choice in it, or finding some way to manufacture a choice or control for yourself, that's actually the first step to creating motivation. Now, that choice might very well be to say, I'm going to be okay with not defining things right now. I'm going to be okay with like letting serendipity take its course. But the point is that you still have to find ways to feel in control of making that choice, that you are proactive rather than just having things forced on you.
So you talk in the book, I guess it's in the appendix to the book, about the motivation chapter and how you created a choice for yourself in order to get your emails responded to when you were busy writing the book.
Yeah. So one of the things that I do, and I still do this today, is I'll sit down and like all of us, I get like an insane number of emails and they drive me nuts. And I hate doing emails. It just feels so boring to me. So in order to motivate myself, what I'll do is I'll sit down and I'll hit reply, reply, reply to everything I want to reply to. And I have like 20, you know, replies on my desktop. And then I go into each one and I type like the clumsiest half sentence possible. But the point of that half sentence is to make a decision. So if someone says like, hey, can you have lunch on Friday? I say, yes, but we have to eat Indian food. Or they say like, hey, can you come to this, you know, can you come cover this event? I say, yeah, but I'll only be there from 11 o'clock to, you know, 12:15. I make any choice. It doesn't even have to be a rational choice. Because once I have a half sentence on that screen with a decision in it, it is really easy to go fill in the rest of it. And oftentimes I change the decision, right? Because I've made the wrong choice. But the point is that a lot of email, a lot of the chores that just feel like burdensome to us, it's because the first step is hard. And the first step often is hard because we don't know exactly what to do. We don't know how to assert our will into that. We know that asserting our will feels good, right? It feels good to make a decision. It feels good when you're stuck in a traffic jam on the highway to say like, I'm going to take that exit, even though it's going to take just as long to get home. It feels good to take control. Once you can get in the habit of pushing yourself to take control to feel good, that's the first step. And then everything else actually seems kind of easy afterwards. It's just, I like plow through all those emails.
You say in the book that people who know how to self-motivate are happier and more successful. So is that people who like learn how to make that choice or understand that turning a challenge into a choice is the best way to get started? Like, is that what makes a self-motivator?
Can you learn to be self-motivated that
Absolutely.
Way?
Yeah, this is one of the things that we know is that self-motivation is like a muscle, that it can be developed and trained. It's actually more like reading, right, or doing math, that you can train anyone to be more self-motivated. And you're exactly right. People who habitually self-motivate well, they have this almost learned habit of finding some choice they can make right away and making that choice. Even if the choice doesn't make any sense, they make it in order to self-motivate, and then they can go and change that choice. And one of my favorite examples of this, and it's in the book, is this study of why some people do so well in nursing homes and others don't. And what they found is that, you know, theoretically, everyone who checks into a nursing home, they should live longer because you're surrounded by medical care, you're surrounded by people who can take care of you. But what we know is that many people who move to nursing homes, they end up dying very quickly. But there's some people who just thrive in nursing homes. And so these researchers went and talked to them. And what they found was that the people who thrive in nursing homes, they refer to them as the subversives because they will do anything to find some choice that they can make. They were talking to this one guy who lived in a nursing home in Santa Fe. And every day he'd get a meal from the nursing home, like a preset meal for him. And he and his friends would sit down at the table and they would all trade their meals. And this guy loved chocolate cake. And every day his preset meal would come with a piece of chocolate cake. And every day he would trade away that piece of chocolate cake for some other dessert. And the researchers asked him why, because he loved chocolate cake. And he said, I would rather eat a meal I hate of my own design than something delicious that's forced on me. That's the mindset that most self-motivated people have. Those are the people who live for years in nursing homes because they're self-motivated to take their medications, to make friends, to have a life, to do exercise. They're the ones who feel like they're in control because they find a way to prove to themselves that they're in control. So if you're at work and you feel like you hate your job, or if you have just some chore that you hate to do, you hate replying to emails, you hate cleaning the house, just find something that proves to you that you are in charge. You are making a choice to do this. And what we know is that neurologically, it's like flipping the switch that makes it easier to motivate and get that thing done. It actually makes it kind of feel like fun.
Take some time and eat some chocolate cake. That's a good life hack. And then you're feeling real self-motivated.
Or don't eat the chocolate cake. Like, go get something you hate too. Because it's your choice.
Right. I don't think he was eating desserts he hated. It was just desserts that he didn't like quite as much as chocolate cake.
And I also feel like from a managerial perspective, you could use this to like give your team control to make decisions and then they'd be more involved in the
Absolutely.
Work.
And we know that Starbucks does this. For instance, Starbucks tells all our baristas that they get to decide where the blender sits. They're the ones who get to decide what goes in the on the walls, those shelves for things that they sell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these seem like totally stupid choices, right?
Well, it seems sort of paternalistic, right?
It seems a little paternalistic, except that it works, right? Because if you're working in like some fast food setting, you feel like you don't have any control. But Starbucks comes in and they're like, look, put the blender wherever you want. You want to change the workflow? Do whatever you want. Like, you are in charge of your life. Now, here's the other part about it, and I'm glad you mentioned management because this is like a really useful thing, I think, for anyone who's managing people. This sense of control is the first part of self-motivation. The second part of self-motivation, to make it really durable, is about linking what you're doing to some actual goal. So there's this one researcher I was talking to. He was a MD PhD at Oxford, and this guy told me that he hates grading students' papers. It's like his least favorite thing. So when he sits down to grade students' papers, he like goes through this mantra every single time, which he says to himself, if I grade these students' papers, then the university can collect tuition dollars. If the university collects tuition dollars, then they can pay for my research. And if they can pay for my research, then I can work on a cure to cancer. And if I work on a cure to cancer, I'm going to save lives. So by grading these students' papers, I am saving lives. Now, that is obviously ridiculous, right? Grading students' papers does not actually save anyone's lives. But more importantly, this dude has a MD, PhD. Like, why does he have to go through a mantra just to make himself grade students' papers?
Why does he have to grade papers?
It's true. Why does he have to grade papers? But, like, the point is that, like, the reason he has an MD, PhD, the reason he's, like, this motivational machine is because he does this mantra, because he links something that he actually doesn't like to a big goal.
Something that has meaning to him.
Something that has meaning, right. And there are parts of every life that involve activities that are not innately pleasurable to us, right? Mm. But if you can remind yourself, and it's easy to forget this, if you can remind yourself that you're doing this small task, you're choosing to do this small task, you're finding a choice in this small task because it actually gets you farther along the path to something you actually care about, that's how you create sustainable motivation. And for managers, that's really important because leaders can help their employees see those links.
That's something that you talk about with the – and this study has come up all over the place with the NUMMI plant.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I love this story. It's a fantastic story. So the NUMMI plant is a car manufacturing plant in California that when it was under General Motors, it was literally the worst car manufacturing plant on earth and in history. Like, and I've talked to people who work there. It was terrible. There was an RV that would come into the parking lot every day with prostitutes in it, and they had it worked out that you could get your session. Yeah, you could get your session in exactly 15-minute increments because the breaks were 18 minutes long. So that gives you enough time to like – and like people would like make bongs out of mufflers. They would get drunk while they were working on the assembly line. It was like a terrible place to work. So they end up shutting down the plant because basically it's so awful. And then Toyota strikes a deal where they want to come make an American plant, and they have a joint venture with General Motors. And basically the only building that they could use to start this new plant to make these Toyota cars was the old GM plant. But because of the union rules, they had to rehire at least 80% of the workers who had been laid off before. So for Toyota, they're being told, yeah, you can come build in the United States, they're a Japanese company, but you have to do it at the worst plant we've ever had with the same workers who are terrible, terrible workers. And Toyota's like, oh no, we got this. We know how to do this. Because they had this secret thing called the Toyota Production System, which is essentially a management style for how you manage workers. And the way that it works is that they took all of the old employees and they flew them to Tokyo, or right outside Tokyo, and they would put them through this training. And the thing about a Toyota plant is that the worker is in charge of everything. So at the GM plant, there was this basic rule, which is that the assembly line never stops. In fact, this one guy had once had a heart attack and had fallen in the pit, and they let the cars rumble over him on the assembly line before pulling his body out to take him to the hospital, because that was the rule. The assembly line never stops. But when all the workers went to the Toyota training facility in Japan, what they saw was that in Toyota plants, there's this thing called an andon cord. The andon cord is just this cord that's hanging above all the workers. And at any point, if a worker feels like they haven't done enough work on the car that's right in front of them, if they're part of the assembly line, or there's some mistake that was made, all they have to do is reach up and pull the andon cord. And that will actually start slowing down the assembly line. And then if they pull the andon cord again, they can actually stop the assembly line. And this was like mind-blowing for all these workers who had been working in this awful GM plant to see that the workers, the line assembly guys and women, they could stop the assembly line. Not only that, but they could boss their managers around. So they could say, I need a new tool and it should look like this. I need all of my gear moved to this side so that I can reach it more easily. The worker was in charge of how the factory functioned. So they go, they get trained in this, they come back to this plant in California, in Fremont, California, which is now called the NUMMI plant, because that's the name of the joint venture between GM and Toyota is called NUMMI. And it's like somebody waved a wand and just revolutionized this entire factory. It became the most productive factory in the United States and then the most productive factory in the world. Those old assembly line workers, they started outperforming their Japanese peers, essentially only because they had been put in charge of themselves. Because when you're in control, when you get to make decisions, you're much more motivated. It taps into innovation. It sort of revolutionizes how quickly we can get things done and how well we can get things done.
Hearing about the original GM plant, it's so interesting that, like, because GM comes up all the time. It comes up a few times in your book. It comes up, like, when people are talking about productivity, it seems like GM has sort of, like, been doing more work than any other company to try to figure out what will work?
I think, yeah, there's a number. So GM, General Electric, has been doing a huge amount of work. And now, because of what's coming out of Silicon Valley, out of the tech industry, we actually have a huge number of models now in terms of new ways of thinking about productivity and about success. It's interesting you bring up General Motors because In the 1950s, General Motors was the most successful, most sort of admired company, not only in America, but pretty much in the world. And General Motors came up with a guy named Sloan, the CEO of General Motors. He came up with an organizational system that was kind of based on the military that is essentially what almost every company uses today. Like when you see an org chart, that org chart was essentially invented by General Motors in the 1950s. So put differently, General Motors came up with a way of thinking about work that spread like a virus through all of corporate America and then all of the world until about 15 or 20 years ago, when all of a sudden these new corporate models started getting invented out of Silicon Valley. Right, when you think about Google, and there's a whole chapter on Google and how Google thinks about getting teams to work together and making teams and empowering them, Google is completely unlike General Motors. Apple is completely unlike General Motors. Amazon is completely unlike General Motors. We are now seeing the emergence of new corporate structures, new business ideas on how to manage people. And they're competing a little bit with each other, right? Uber is different from Apple, is different from Amazon, is different from Google. One or two of them will win, and our grandchildren, they will live in a world that is a Google world or is an Amazon world, and they won't even realize that it used to be different, the same way that we live in a corporate world and we don't realize that GM invented it.
How does that relate, do you think, to teams and like the large teams at Google or wherever? Because you want people to have this sense of control and decisions, but you also need to have a team working together towards a single goal. So how does that work, that sense of choice and teamwork?
One of the things that Google has done, Google's done a couple of things around, they study their teams very, very intensely. One of the things that they do is they create an internal marketplace. So basically, if you work at Google, you can change the team you work on simply by raising your hand and saying, like, I want to go over there, right? Managers are competing for workers. And this empowers workers because, for one thing, it gives you a huge amount of autonomy and control. You can say, I want to go work on the project that I want to work on. But secondarily, it also forces managers to become good managers because they want to attract the best talent, as opposed to like an auto plant where you're assigned to some team and you're just on that team. You don't get to move. Your manager is oftentimes in control. But that's part of what Google has done around teams. I think they understand that empowering people is how you allocate resources in the best way possible. But they also understand that oftentimes productivity is a science and that we can understand that science. So Google did this huge project called Project Aristotle to study all of their teams and try and figure out why some teams were succeeding and other teams were failing. And their teams are relatively small. Usually a Google team is like 7 to 9 people, maybe as many as 12. And what they found, their initial hypothesis was you need to have the right mix of people, right? So maybe you want to have introverts and extroverts together, or maybe you want to have people who are friends away from the conference room so that they like all know each other. Maybe you have like a flat leadership or a one person who's clearly a strong leader. And they looked at all the data on all of those variables and couldn't find any patterns at all. After a while, after basically a year and spending a couple $1 million on this, they started saying, well, instead of looking at who's on a team to try and figure out how to build the best teams, why don't we look at how teams function to see if that differentiates between the best and the worst? And all of a sudden, they found that that was the key, that who doesn't matter very much at all, but how a team interacts is the main driver of whether it functions productively and successfully or not. And in particular, there were these two group norms, these two behaviors that they found made a team successful. The first was this thing called equality and conversational turn-taking. Basically, in a team meeting, does everyone speak up in roughly equal proportion? Now, that doesn't mean everyone says the same number of words, but it does mean that, you know, over a month or two, everyone will basically speak roughly equally, and that there's no one who stands against the wall during a meeting and kind of just listens and never says anything. But speaking up and forcing people to speak up, that's not enough on its own. You also have to have the second group norm, the second group behavior, which is called ostentatious listening. When someone speaks up, do I show them that I've heard them? Do I pick up on nonverbal cues? Do I draw people into the conversation by asking them their opinion and then reflecting back what they just said? What they found, and other studies have found this in other settings, is that if you have these two characteristics, you have what's known as psychological safety. Psychological safety seems to be the like linchpin for making a team function well. Because if people feel like they have to speak up and that other people really hear them, then they actually feel like they're participating in that group. The whole becomes more than just the sum of its parts.
One question I want to ask you, just because it stood out to me, is that you mentioned this as it's like a one-line thing, which is good teams contain more women.
Yeah.
I'm curious about that.
Yeah. So there's a huge amount of research that actually shows this. And the reason why is because this social sensitivity. So the ostentatious listening, it's oftentimes expressed in the academic literature as social sensitivity, that I have the ability to pick up on your nonverbal cues and to say things back. Women in general have higher social sensitivity than men. There's this really interesting study or this test called the Reading the Mind in the Eyes test, which anyone can Google. It's awesome. It just basically shows you a bunch of photos of people's eyes and you have to guess what emotions they're feeling. Women are much better at that test on average than men are because they have higher social sensitivity. Dozens of studies have shown that when teams include at least two women, and oftentimes three will be even better, that the average social sensitivity goes up, and as a result, there's more psychological safety. There's more communication on that team. Now, its key is not to have just one woman, because that one woman will feel like she's totally outnumbered. It's also interesting because what happens is that men tend to act differently on teams when there are women on the teams than when there's just men. So it seems to dampen the competition and increase the social sensitivity and listening. So it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's totally fascinating. So, of course, I have to ask you what you make of Trump's team. And, you know, you talk in the book when you talk about SNL, you talk about how, like when people talk about it, they talk about it as this, like, incredibly fruitful place where everybody was working together and it was wonderful. But really, like, they were at each other's throats. They felt competitive. There was all this stuff going on. I would imagine that Trump's team has more in common with the original SNL team than it does with, like, these high-functioning teams at Google, or maybe I'm
That's really interesting. I hadn't even thought about that. You're exactly so, like, one of the chapters is about Saturday Night Live and why it was successful. And, like, if you had walked into, like, one of the original writers' rooms of Saturday Night Live, you would see, like, you know, John Belushi, like, stoned out of his mind in the corner. Al Franken and his writing partner, who, of course, is a senator now, like, they would be bouncing off the walls because they're, like, coked to the gills. Half the people in the room would have slept with each other in the last 3 months and not be speaking to each other as a result. Like, there was all these – and, by the way, if your skit got put on the air, it meant someone else's sketch was cut. So you're right. It was, like, this, like, viper den. It could have turned out terribly. But Lorne Michaels, the executive producer – he does this thing. He forces everyone at the table to talk. He shows these huge ostentatious listening behaviors. And it's interesting when you mention that. I don't know, because I don't know much about the – like, we've been trying to report on the Trump administration and we have trouble getting in – you know,
right.
Knowing what really happens inside the rooms.
Right.
You know, it's interesting because I've talked to people who worked for Trump as a real estate developer, and they do say he's very empowering. Right. Like, I mean, and this might be a knock against him, is that, like, he doesn't really want to know the details. Right. He hires someone and he's like, go do what you need to do. Like, you don't need to tell me what's going on.
Right. I don't care what you're doing, yeah, Mike Flynn. Just go do your thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That might if you don't hire the right people, that's not a great thing. And it might also mean that he has, like, more time to, like, tweet crazy things. But it is interesting that, like, this empowering behavior is a good behavior. And frankly, it might have been why, you know, he sort of surprisingly ended up winning the election, was because he managed his team in a very different way than, for instance, Hillary Clinton did, where it was very top-down. It was very command and control.
So we're talking about Trump's team and the way he tends to delegate without necessarily understanding all the details. And maybe for him that's working, but can't you do both? Like, actually understand what the person is doing and also kind of delegate to them?
Absolutely. And I'm not certain that it's, like, working for him right now. Right.
Right?
Like, I think if anything, we're seeing the limitations of delegation without actually understanding what people are doing. Mm. I mean, it's interesting because I feel like in some respects, you know, I became a manager at the New York Times from being a journalist. And now I'm going back to being a journalist sort of as my reward for being a manager. And the thing I carried away about being a manager is that your main job is to take seriously whatever the people who you're working with, whatever they take seriously. So if someone comes and they say, I have a problem with X, even if I don't think that's a problem, my job is to say, yeah, that's a problem. Let's solve that together. To understand intimately what the people who I'm empowering, what obstacles are in their way, and then to help remove those obstacles. The empowerment's really important, but then knowing how to help, knowing what people are actually doing so you can help them do it better.
Right.
That's also very important.
Although I wouldn't want to remove obstacles from Steve Bannon, but
well, depending on where you sit on the
right.
they seem to be doing a pretty good job of creating obstacles for themselves right now. So.
Yeah.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
One of the parts of your book that I will lie awake thinking about for the rest of my life, maybe, is the chapter about focus, because there's more than one absolutely terrifying TikTok account of a plane crash. And it is so terrifying to see like why things go wrong in the cockpit and just knowing what's going on in a cockpit. Like I saw Flight. I know what can go wrong in there. That's the name of that movie, right? With
What's his name?
Is that the Denzel one?
Right.
Where's the alcoholic?
That is a firm. We are in an uncontrolled You
take us through this absolutely terrifying things that go wrong before a plane crash, before telling us about people who make the right decisions or don't go into this cognitive tunnel or whatever.
Right.
So can you tell us a little bit about that? And also, were you terrified? Are you as terrified as I am that every plane you are on is going to go down now? Because I don't know if I can fly again.
So that chapter. That chapter is about Air France Flight 447 and Qantas Flight 32. And I actually was writing that chapter while I was on an airplane. And the guy next to me – so I had all these documents about crash reports that I was using to get details from. And the dude next to me actually called the stewardess and was like, "I need to talk to you. I think the guy next to me is going to crash this plane." This is midair. So he doesn't come back, and I don't really notice. I'm like, "Oh, that guy's in the bathroom a long time." And then a stewardess comes over, and she's like, "Sir, we need to talk to you." And she was like, "Do you mind standing up?" And I was like, "Yeah, I've never had this happen." And as soon as I stand up, three other stewardesses or stewards stand around me so that I can't really move. I mean, they didn't constrain me, but they were like, "We've noticed that can you tell us a little bit about the reading material that you're looking at right now?" And I was like, Oh, no, I'm a journalist. I'm not trying to crash anything. And they understood totally. There was no long-term consequences for it. But the one takeaway for me is do not research an airplane crash while on an airplane. It does not go over well.
Can you imagine looking over at the guy next to you and he's reading how to crash a plane or why planes crash?
There are all these photos. It's totally – So you're exactly right. The chapter on focus, the big question at the center of that chapter is – what do we know about the neurology of focus that allows some people to remain so focused so well and other people get distracted? And it's not just plane crashes. I mean, that's a really dramatic way of telling the story. But in many ways, a plane cockpit is like any office you walk into at this point, right? When you walk in the morning, there are 100 emails waiting for you and your phone is buzzing in your pocket and there's people stopping by your desk saying "Hey, can I talk to you for 5 minutes?" And there's little dings coming up to remind you that you got a meeting coming up and you said maybe you're going to go, right? Every workplace is so chaotic now that remaining focused is a challenge. But we know, and studies have shown this again and again, that the most successful people, they are successful in large part because they manage to focus on the right tasks and maintain that focus and not get distracted by things that seem important at the time, but in retrospect should have been ignored. So when I was looking into this, actually the most inspiring story that I heard was the second story in that chapter, the story of Qantas Flight 32. And Qantas Flight 32 is a story most people aren't familiar with because the plane is Australian. But it's this plane that took off from the Singapore airport, I believe in 2010, and basically had the worst mid-air mechanical disaster in modern aviation. There was they lift off into the air, and it's an Airbus A380. It's one of those huge airplanes. And what happens is that a fire breaks out in one of the jet engines, and one of the jet fan blades, the fire causes the fan blade to detach from the shaft. And as the fan blade detaches, it shoots through the wing and punches this huge hole in the wing. And it also hits another fan blade. And that fan blade shatters into thousands of pieces. And it's like a bomb going off inside the wing. The shrapnel cuts through hydraulics lines and electrical lines and fuel lines. Basically, within seconds, the plane had 12 of the 14 major systems that are needed to keep it aloft all knocked out. And what's interesting is that the captain of that plane is this guy named Richard de Crespigny. And he had been trained in how to fly by the Australian Air Force. And the Australian Air Force, like all air forces, teaches people a way of thinking when they're flying, how to maintain focus that's known as situational awareness. And we're probably familiar with this term because they use it in a lot of different settings now, but it actually comes from aviation. And what situational awareness says is we control our focus and our attention by building mental models. And we build mental models by telling ourselves stories of what is happening as it occurs. So that instinct that we all have to kind of like narrate our life inside our heads, that's actually a really good instinct because that's how your brain decides what to focus on. And Richard de Crespigny, the guy who is the captain of Qantas Flight 32, he loved this stuff. Like before that flight, that morning, he did this thing that he did before every flight, which is when they were in the shuttle from the hotel to the airport, he asked his co-pilots to tell him stories about what they would do in case of an emergency. He would say stuff like, if engine 2 goes out, tell me the first thing you're going to say, where your eye is going to go, where are you going to put your hands? Like, tell me a story minute by minute of what you'll do if we lose engine 2. And if you listen to the cockpit recording right after this emergency happens, what you hear is basically people speaking as if they're reading from a script. They speak in these short, clipped sentences. Everyone reacts exactly as they're supposed to. There's no panic whatsoever. And in like 99% of cases, that would have saved all the people on board that plane. The problem in this case was that there were so many problems. This is the worst mechanical disaster in modern aviation. There were so many emergencies that literally as soon as they would solve one problem, like five new problems would pop up. There weren't enough scripts inside anyone's head to keep track of what was going on. And so de Crespigny, in the middle of this emergency, does this really interesting thing. He takes his hands off of the controls. He closes his eyes. Now, keep in mind, literally the alarms are going off in the cabin. They can't control almost anything. And he decides to change the story that's in his head. He decides to start imagining that instead of flying an Airbus A380, he's flying a Cessna, which is the plane that he learned to fly on. Now, a Cessna basically has nothing in common with an Airbus A380. But as soon as he makes that shift, he has this new story in his head that starts telling him what to pay attention to and what to ignore. And so he looks at all the alarms and he says, like, none of these alarms matter because none of them would be on a dashboard of a Cessna. The only alarm that exists in a Cessna is that one right there. And that's the one I'm going to focus on. And they manage to turn the plane around and to start heading back to the Singapore airport. And as they're getting closer and closer to the airport, all these alarms are going off. They have no idea if the brakes are even going to work. But de Crespigny in his head is saying, I'm flying a Cessna. I'm flying a Cessna. And so he makes all these decisions that he would make as if he was flying a Cessna. And they end up landing the plane, and all 469 people on board get off safely without one injury. Now, they've tried to recreate that landing in simulators like 100 times. Nobody has ever landed that plane without killing everyone on board. He might have just gotten lucky. But I think what really happened was he controlled the story in his head. And so he paid attention to the right things.
Just going through day-to-day life, we create these stories for ourselves. Some of them are useful to us, like what you're describing, and give us the right mental models. But other times we create these stories for ourselves that lead to all kinds of anxiety and worry. And we're sort of like we're choosing the wrong data points to read. And so how do we like figure out how to choose the right data points so that we're telling ourselves the right stories?
So I think part of it is getting in the habit, right? So the underlying idea of smarter, faster, better, the idea that goes through the entire book is that the most productive, most successful people, they build mental habits that force them to think more deeply. But thinking is hard, right? Thinking is particularly hard when you're like walking into an office or when you're in the middle of a plane emergency. That's when we're most likely to stop thinking. So how do we build the habits that push us to think more deeply? It's a great question you just asked because I think it gets to the heart of this. If you're in the habit of choosing the story you're telling yourself, then at a moment when the pressure is on, it's much easier to tell the story that you want to be telling to yourself. And I think, so one of the ways that I do this, for instance, is every morning when I'm taking the subway from Brooklyn into Manhattan, I have a rule that I close my eyes for like 3 minutes and I literally just tell myself a story about the day that's about to occur. So like I tell myself a story like, what am I going to have done by 10 o'clock? What am I going to do before I go to lunch? What am I going to eat for lunch? It takes like literally 2 or 3 minutes to do this. But I'm in the habit of telling myself the story, and it's the story I choose. It's not the story of like, everything's going to go to hell and I'm going to get overwhelmed. It's a story of like, here's how this day is going to be killer, man. And then as a result, when I'm at my desk and like all of a sudden like everything is like falling apart, it's really easy for me to lapse back into that story. Like I'm practiced. I'm in the habit of choosing the story I want to tell myself. Just tell yourself like the best fairy tale possible about how this date or how this meeting or how this day is going to go. And then if reality doesn't live up to it, that's okay because you're getting in the habit of training your brain to build a mental model that will cause it to be more successful.
It's like the author Richard Yates talks about the council of victory versus the council of defeat and like deciding to listen to the council of victory rather than the council of defeat.
That's exactly right. And like the thing is, this can tip over into like the secret pretty easily, right? Like just visualize what you want in the world. But like, and that is not true. Simple visualization does not like make you thinner and richer. But there is a core of something in that, right? This is why athletes like Michael Phelps, why they play out the perfect race in their head every single night before they go to sleep, and why it feels like it's kind of anticlimactic when he actually sets a world record, is because he's done it so many times in his brain, right? That council of victory, we get to choose which one we listen to. But the key is we have to make it a habit to listen to the right one, because then when the pressure's on, when it's easiest to stop thinking, then you fall back on your habit and you say, okay, what story do I want to apply to what's going on right now? What's the one that's going to get me closer to my goal rather than farther away?
By contrast, can you talk a little about the other flight who didn't handle the situation as well?
Yeah, so Air France Flight 447.
You're trying to give me nightmares, Andy. Like I've lived through this again.
So most people probably remember 447. It crashed into the ocean, killing everyone on board. It was a flight from Rio de Janeiro that was headed towards Paris. There was no reason the plane should have crashed. So they had this, when they were, there was an ice storm that came when they were at a very high altitude that caused one of their sensors to freeze over a little bit and they lost airspeed information. And then it unfroze. Like this is something that like literally happens all the time that pilots know how to deal with. But the pilots on board that plane, they had no mental model. Like if you look at the cockpit recordings and see what they say, they literally had no story in their head to fall back on to make sense of what was going on. So as a result, they started making all these choices that caused the plane to literally plummet out of the sky. If they had just sat on their hands, everyone on board would have been saved.
Were they instead like reacting to all the alerts and just constantly making changes or what?
Yeah, exactly. They were reacting. So basically whatever alert popped up like most recently was the one that they instantly pounced on. And they fell into this thing called a cognitive tunnel. So a cognitive tunnel, we've all experienced this actually. When you're driving down the freeway and you're like going the speed limit and you see a cop car out of the corner of your eye and you hit the brake needlessly, that's a cognitive tunnel. Or when you're at home and you're like making dinner and like talking to your spouse and taking care of the kids and suddenly like your boss sends you a text and you like fixate on it and you like type some reply and hit send. And as soon as you hit send, you're like, I really wish I'd waited to hit send and reread that. That's a cognitive tunnel. A cognitive tunnel is how our brain naturally reacts. When we feel overwhelmed, it tends to latch on to the most obvious stimuli. So the most obvious stimuli in an airplane cockpit is the alarm that's right in front of your eyes instead of all the other alarms that might be off to the side. And they would just get fixated. In fact, one pilot in particular, he got fixated on getting the wings on the little like dashboard thing in front of him, on getting the wings exactly centered, which was like the least important thing for him to do at that moment. But he was totally overwhelmed. He was in a cognitive tunnel. So he just got fixated on that and it caused the plane to stall, which means that the upward lift on it wasn't there. And so literally it just dropped like a stone into the ocean.
You know, we don't have to go into, but just like the hubris of the pilots and like all of the personalities of them, it just makes you think, you know, in this actual real world situation and not in a cinematic depiction that, like, these are human beings that are flying planes and that are, you know, that are surgeons. And, you know, in these situations that are specifically life or death, it, like, people make these errors, or they, you know, their undoing is also our undoing.
Well, and that's a fascinating point, because one of the big questions for that guy, Richard Dekrebny, the guy who saved Qantas Flight 32, is why was he able to change the story in his head so easily? And I think the answer is, and other people have sort of confirmed this, if you talk to Richard Dekrebny, and I've talked to him probably half a dozen times, you will find out he is the most argumentative human being on the face of the planet. Like, he will literally pick a fight with you over anything. And in fact, that morning when they were in that shuttle taking the – and he told his co-pilots, like, tell me a story about what happens if Engine 2 goes out. He would argue with them about the story they told. He'd be like, why are you going to do that with your hands? Why is that the first words out of your mouth? And I think the reason he was able to suddenly come up with a new mental model so quickly is because he is in the habit of changing his mind. He's in the habit of questioning everything. So, which actually means he'd be a terrible human being to have a beer with, right? He's like not a great guy to hang out with, but he's exactly the kind of person you want flying an airplane, to your point that humans fly these planes and you want people who have certain habits. One of those habits is telling themselves stories, but the other habit is questioning that story. That's often why the best executives, they have people on their team who disagree with them constantly, right? And you'll talk to executives and they'll actually say, like, I don't really like Jim, my SVP. Like, every time we're in a meeting together, it's like kind of like there's some tension there. But that's why I need Jim on my team, is because he constantly questions me and he helps me figure out, like, is the frame in my mind, is the mental model, the story I'm telling myself, is it the right one, or should I be looking at this from a different perspective?
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Something that sort of, like, undergirds or, like, every conversation that we have about focus and about being productive is technology. And I'm, you know, I feel like the struggle that we all have day to day is basically, like, with our phones or with our devices. Like, everything that you're saying is all well and good if I can put my phone down, if I can, like, stop checking Twitter, if I can stop checking text, if I can, you know, stop playing Candy Crush, whatever it is, if people still play Candy Crush.
And what do they play now? I don't know.
I secretly still play Candy Crush. I wanted to act like I was beyond it, but that's where I go. I don't know what you guys are doing, but how does the day-to-day struggle of us against our, you know, the lure of technology sort of undo all of our efforts to get focused?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. Imagine we were having this conversation like 30 years ago or even 20 years ago. And like afterwards, we went back to our desks. Like there would be a typewriter on your desk and a telephone. Can you imagine like how awesome that would be?
There's so few variables, right?
Like it's like, am I going to type a letter or am I going to call someone?
Right.
Or am I going to read the paper? I don't know. Like, right. Like, what would you do with all that free time?
I could turn the light on or off.
Yeah, but that's also so scary because, like, you'd have to do something. You can't just sit there and
you'd
fiddle
have
with your
to
computer.
Yeah, it's true. You'd have to have a to-do list, right? You'd have to, like, actually be productive. But what's interesting is if you look at, like, diaries from people during just 30 years ago or 100 years ago, they talk about how busy they are, how distracted they feel. Mm-hmm. They talk about the fact that, like, there's constantly, like, too much stuff to do and they're getting pulled away from what they want to concentrate on. There's actually this, like, great quote by Erasmus, which is something to the effect of, I wish that I had enough time to read all the books that I need to read because there must be at least 5,000 books in the world, right? And this is a guy, like, and he's probably right. There's probably about 5,000 books in the world at that point. And even he felt overwhelmed by all the distractions. There's two answers. The first of which is, we're living through a revolution, right? We're living through an economic and a technological revolution. And during these periods, and we know this from looking at the Industrial Revolution and the Agrarian Revolution, there's always an unbalance as we learn to use new technologies. When the telephone was first invented, or when it was popularized, people complained incessantly about getting interrupted by telephone calls. And then essentially what happened is that an etiquette emerged where, like, you don't call someone unless you really need to talk to them. But it used to be that there were party lines. People would call for no reason the same way that they would email. So we're in an age where we're still trying to figure out the etiquette around technology. Also, telephones changed. It went from party lines to direct calls, in part because people felt like party lines were too distracting. They needed something that was more efficient. And so our technology, which bings in our pockets and vibrates, and it's going to change. It will stabilize to what's useful. And we're already seeing that happen. That's why people use email so much less now, is because these other, if you think about Slack or texting, it's actually an etiquette change. It's lower threshold for forcing you to respond. But all that aside, the real insight is it doesn't matter. We're blaming technology for a problem that's inside our heads. The reason why you get distracted is because you allow yourself to be distracted. You would have been distracted by your typewriter and the telephone 30 years ago, and today you're being distracted by your computer and Twitter and Facebook and X, Y, and Z. The more that you sit down and you look at how you actually spend your time and think to yourself, how do I tell myself a story about the next hour? If I told myself a successful story about this morning, would it involve looking at Twitter or would it involve not having that application open?
You spoke to the brilliant Timothy Pitchell about to-do lists.
Yeah.
And he's one of my favorites on procrastination. He's such a fascinating guy.
He is a really interesting guy.
As we're trying to plan our days, what does a good to-do list look like?
Okay, so this is a great question. And I will say I've changed entirely how I do my to-do list.
Okay.
So most of us do to-do lists the same way. We use it as an external memory aid, right? We write down just a list of things that we want to get done, basically anything that we want to get done, from the big to the small. Now, the problem with that is that our brain has a natural evolutionary instinct to find the easiest things on that list and do them first because it feels so good to cross them off, right? It feels productive.
Yeah
you're nodding like you did, like you made me do that. So what Timothy told me, and I think it's, and studies should bear out, is the problem with doing a to-do list that way is that that's using a to-do list not for productivity. That's using a to-do list for mood repair, right? That's using a to-do list to make yourself feel better. So how do the most productive, successful people write to-do lists? Totally different. They do have a list of all the tasks, right? They use it. They have a memory aid list because you don't want to carry everything around in your brain. But that's not their to-do list. That's something that they put out of sight. What their to-do list is that on a piece of paper, they write down basically three things. The most important thing that I want to get done today, the most important thing that I want to get done this week, and a third thing that if I actually get one of those two things done, this is the third most important thing to do. That's using a to-do list to force yourself to think about your priorities, not just for mood repair, but to actually force yourself to ask, what is actually important? What is productive and what is simply busy? We tend to think of to-do lists as things that should be dumping grounds, that they should be big. It's the opposite. They should be small. They should be priorities. Similarly, with email, to get back to email, there's a similar rule in place, which is I used to, at the end of each day, count up how many emails I had sent and use that as a mark of my productivity. Like, I sent 80 emails today and 70 yesterday. I must have been 10 emails more productive today. But now I do the exact opposite. If I send more than 10 emails that aren't like emails to my wife or like nonsense, I have to justify each of those extra emails because the more email you send, the more email you're going to get. The more email you send, the more time you have wasted not doing something else. My goal now is to send fewer and fewer emails every single day because that means that I spent all of my time doing something else.
Do you ever feel like some people obsess about to-do lists too much? Like, I'm sure some of our listeners are going to try to make their perfect three-step list, but they're going to spend an hour trying to make these decisions.
Yeah, so absolutely. So, and the thing I would say is, if you're spending an hour doing it, then you're not doing the experiment right. It's much, or the same thing comes true of telling yourself stories, building mental models. Because sometimes people say, like, I build mental models, but then I get trapped in, like, which choice I should make. The goal is not to do it right away. The goal is to build a habit that is healthy. And to build a habit, oftentimes we have to do things wrong. So sit down and come up with your three most important things for today. If that takes more than 4 minutes, then just write down whatever you want. And maybe at noon you'll be like, this is the dumbest list I've ever come up with. I should have put this other thing on it. Like, but that, now you know for tomorrow, it's going to be much easier to write that to-do list. You don't have to do it perfect the first time. The goal is to build habits that force you, that encourage you to think more deeply. We build habits through repetition, not by nailing it perfectly when we start. And this also gets to a bigger point, which I think Smarter, Faster, Better really embraces. Every choice that we make is an experiment, right? People who are successful are people who experiment a lot. And my wife is a scientist, so I think about this all the time. The goal of experiments is not to have the experiment work the way you expect every single time. If you conduct a bunch of experiments and the results come out exactly as you expected, that means you messed up, right? The goal of experiments is to have some things fail and learn why they fail. The goal of experiments is to push things to a level where it all falls apart. An experiment ought to fail regularly. So if you're doing everything exactly right, you are not being the best version of yourself you can be. You should be failing at your to-do list. You should be failing at focus. You should be failing at some project you took on that's too ambitious, at least some percentage of the time, because that means that not only are you pushing yourself hard enough, but that you're putting yourself in a position to learn something new so that you don't fail the next time you do it.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So, as usual, we like to round out the show with our own upgrades this week. Charles, have you done anything this week to improve your life?
Yeah, I just got off an airplane, and I've decided two things about airplanes. Number one is, it is always okay to watch TV on an airplane. Because I fly a lot, and I found out what was happening is that I'd set up all my work to do on an airplane, and I do a lot of work on airplanes. But, like, if I got tired and I wanted to watch TV, I'd always, like, feel bad about myself, right? Like, and so I just decided, like, that feeling bad about myself, that was actually super counterproductive. It was making me less productive to feel bad about myself, because then I would go do work and I'd be like, I wouldn't do good work. So I've just decided from now on, it is okay to watch TV on airplanes. Like, airplanes are like a safe space for watching TV. I don't have to judge myself for it. And that doesn't mean that I don't want to get work done on airplanes, but if I need a break, it's totally okay to watch TV. The second thing, and this isn't this week, but this is something that this guy Tim O'Reilly told me about, is, and I've been doing this for a while, we were talking about the emotional impact of email, right? That someone sends you an email and you feel like an obligation to reply. And what he said, and I thought this was really smart, is he said, what if we just imagine that every email was a suggestion instead of a command? Because the thing is, if you're like, I want to go to dinner, and your friend is like, oh, let me suggest this one Italian restaurant, you don't feel like you actually have to go to that Italian restaurant. You're like, oh, thanks for the suggestion. Maybe I'll go, but maybe I feel like Chinese. If you think of emails as suggestions instead of obligations, it's much easier to hit the delete button on things that you know it's okay to ignore. Because if it's really important, they'll send you a second email or they'll call you on the phone. And that's actually been kind of life-changing for me.
That sounds like a pretty good suggestion.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. Not a command. You can do whatever you
Not
want.
Not a command.
So you can take it. You can walk away.
That's right. That's right. Melissa, have you done anything this week?
This week I've started thinking, and I think about this from time to time, but I actually made a change based on this week, which was like thinking about what my time is worth. Like if I'm paying myself by the hour, what are the things that like I don't want to do or I feel are not worth my money? And one of those is grocery shopping sometimes. So I like grocery shopping, but I live in a part of Brooklyn where there aren't a ton of really good grocery stores, or there are grocery stores, but they're super duper expensive. So it takes me a long time sometimes to go and get everything that I need. So I've given myself permission to use this incredible invention, Instacart, which I think people know about. You know, it's an online grocery shopping service where you can shop online and they deliver your groceries within an hour or something. And I'm not going to use it all the time, but using it this week where I felt like I would rather, you know, pay whatever fee I have to pay in order to get my groceries delivered, that is more valuable to me. My time is more valuable than the time that I would have spent grocery shopping. So that's
I totally get behind that.
Right. Myself, I've been reclaiming Saturdays lately as an opportunity to be completely lazy. Like if I have any tasks I actually need to do, if I need to do laundry or do whatever, if I'm invited out but I don't want to go, I'm taking my Saturdays just to sleep in, you know, order seamless, whatever, just be purely indulgence. And then on Sunday, I can start to get back to real life. But Saturday, I'm just keeping it for myself lately.
So Saturdays are like like flights to Charles.
Yes.
Your Saturdays.
Yes,
right?
I'm allowed to watch TV.
Right, without guilt.
I'm flying on the Saturday airplane.
Right.
That's right.
Very good.
Except that you have full Netflix and Hulu and Apple TV.
Like, that's right.
That's the best airplane and seamless. That's like the best airplane possible.
So that's our show. You can find me on Twitter at Melissa Kirsch. You can find Andy at Andy Orin. And you can contact Charles Duhigg at charles@charlesduhigg.com. The Upgrade is produced by Levi Sharp. Our executive editor of audio is Mandana Mofidi. Brad Fisher mixed the episode. Do you have a suggestion for a future episode of The Upgrade? Shoot us an email at upgrade@lifehacker.com. Tweet us at lifehacker using the hashtag TheUpgrade. Or go old school and leave us a voice message at 347-687-8109. And if you love The Upgrade, which it's pretty clear you do since you're listening to the credits of it, go to iTunes and leave us a review. Follow Lifehacker on Twitter at Lifehacker and on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.